This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump's presence in the White House has left many Americans with a sense of hopelessness. But the president does not dictate every aspect of our communities. Local organizing has long been taking place around the country to build resiliency and just systems, no matter who leads the federal government. Surveying that local grassroots organizing during a 12,000-mile journey around the U.S. is Yes Magazine's Sarah Van Gelder. In a new book called The Revolution Where You Live, Van Gelder tells the stories of ordinary Americans doing extraordinary things, models that are sure to inspire hope in these dark times. Sarah Van Gelder is the co-founder and editor-at-large at Yes Magazine. She's also the editor of Sustainable Happiness, Living Simply, Live Well, Make a Difference, and This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street, and the 99% Movement. She now joins me to discuss her new book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So what prompted this? Obviously, back in, I think it was 2015 when you started your journey, you didn't really have any way of knowing that we would be where we are today. Your book seems so relevant, so meaningful in this moment. What prompted you to get on this van that you bought and go on this huge journey?
Well, since we started, yes, 20 years ago, we've been looking at some of the really big questions that have been affecting our times. Things like inequality and racism, things like climate change and the degradation of our environment. So when we're looking at that, you know that they're powerful in society and just need to look for where are they showing up and where are solutions to them showing up. So that's the question we've had for the whole time we've been producing Yes Magazine. And in 2015, I was thinking about our 20th anniversary that was coming up, and I was thinking about how stuck we are in some of those big issues. We're really not making progress on inequality, even though unemployment numbers have come down. The climate crisis is coming faster than we thought. And racism, some President Obama's inauguration to create a post-racial society, and of course that is not at all what happened. So on all these issues, they're still very much present. And I just felt like, you know, I need to go out and see for myself, where are they coming up with solutions? Where are they coming up with solutions that are outside the mainstream media view? Where are they coming up with solutions outside of the power centers that may be less wedded to the old status quo, maybe more ready to try things that could really work at the community scale?
So among the places that you visited were several Native American reservations, and of course the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline that began last year really symbolized a very powerful and unified resistance to the kind of treaty encroachment, the power of the fossil fuel industry that specific community was fighting back against. Tell us about some of the stories that you discovered in these five reservations, I think it was, that you visited. I mean, unfortunately, the stories that we often hear from Native American reservations are bleak, are one of alcoholism and rape and these terrible public health indicators, or they're one of wealth, you know, of casinos and money made that way. We don't hear the stories that you tell.
Well, I went to one place in southeast Montana where there was a huge coal mine proposed in a beautiful, pristine valley called the Otter Creek Valley. And the reason I found out about it was because the Lummi tribe, near where I live in Seattle, the Lummi tribe had been fighting against a huge coal terminal that would have facilitated the export of millions of tons of coal. And they'd been fighting against that for years. And I got curious, where was that coal going to come from? And how did the people feel about that much mining taking place in their territory? It turned out that was going to be adjacent to the reservation of the Northern Cheyenne tribe and on the land of a number of ranchers. And I visited them. I had an opportunity to spend some time on the land of the Northern Cheyenne, staying with a woman named Elena Buffalo Spirit, and interviewed her and her family, interviewed ranchers out there. And they were united in not wanting that mine to come in and not wanting the railroad spur that would come in. And I happened to be there also just when the Lummi tribe was coming with a totem pole that they had carved as a gift to the Northern Cheyenne tribe as a symbol of solidarity, to say, you know, you would be affected at one end of this process, we would be affected at another end of this process, but none of us want this thing. And remarkably, there is something about the unity of all of these folks working so hard together, coming from a place of deep respect for the land and the water and the place that they come from. The ranchers and the native people both talking about how they had inherited this beautiful, precious land and water, and they had the responsibility, the moral responsibility, the sacred responsibility to pass it along intact to their children and to future generations. And I was so struck by that unity and purpose. And even though the native people, of course, had been there so much longer than the ranchers acknowledged that. And they said, yeah, we understand that you all have this much deeper claim to this land. And yet this is something we all have in common. And in the end, they were able to defeat that mine.
And those sorts of stories where resistance to extractive industries keeps blossoming, they don't always make national news like the Dakota Access Pipeline did. You did go to North Dakota before the pipeline project became this huge story. And tell us about the fracking projects that are being resisted in North Dakota as well.
So I went first to the Fort Berthold Reservation, which is where there's this huge fracking boom going on. It's brought in millions of dollars. So some people are getting very wealthy. It's brought in enormous numbers of workers from outside the region who camp in these places they call man camps, which have become places that attract human trafficking, that attract drug trafficking. They've become centers of criminal activities of all sorts. All of that activity has also been polluting the water and digging up and the air and messing with the infrastructure, so that there's enormous expenses now that the tribe has to take on to deal with the law enforcement, the social services, the infrastructure problems. So on the one hand, all this money has come through, and for an impoverished tribe, that sounded really tempting. And on the other hand, they've had just so many difficulties. So I spent some time there and interviewed some folks there at Fort Berthold. And then I went to another reservation called the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation in the northern part of North Dakota, and they had decided to do the opposite. They decided to ban fracking, and it happened when one of the elders brought the women together and said, you know, the women in our tradition are responsible for the quality of the water, so we need to understand this question of what's going to happen if fracking comes in here. And so they researched it, and they realized it was not something they wanted. They took it to the tribal council. They shared their alarm at what might happen to their water, the quality of their water in this beautiful, pristine part of North Dakota, and also what would happen to their culture and their society if they had this huge infusion of people from outside with all that money. And they decided to ban fracking from their reservation. And they did it just in time to stop a bunch of leases that the BIA had planned to auction off. And right. When I got there, I had a chance to interview the tribal chairman. I said, do you regret that you're leaving all this money on the table? And he goes, no, not at all. I can see that money doesn't buy happiness. All I have to do is look at what's going on in Fort Berthold.
Right. I mean, and so it's really powerful to hear these stories because, you know, the amount of mobilization that the Dakota Access Pipeline garnered and the suffering of those folks on the front line and the thousands of, you know, hours of energy that was poured into that struggle eclipses these smaller victories, actually, that should inspire us, that should give us heart. Let's talk about Chicago. Chicago is a city that the Republicans would like us to think is basically the birthplace of gun violence, and that's all it is. Not just gun violence. Of course, they characterize it as black on black violence, black on black crime. But Chicago is also this incredible urban community, has these incredible urban communities where people are finding hope through simple things like growing and consuming their own fresh food. Tell us about what you found in Chicago that can be a model that could be replicated in cities around the country.
Well, there are two places I visited. One was Growing Power, where they are doing that kind of urban farming. They took an old warehouse that had some acreage around it, converted it into a farm, and are also raising fish and growing worms and raising mushrooms and so on, that are all part of a really smart farm ecosystem. And they're doing it with training young people from the community to become farmers. So they're making it a way of life that's also a livelihood. They have their own farm stand. They have a beautiful painted bus, and they take the produce around to places that don't get access to fresh food. As we know, there's these huge areas of our country that are essentially food deserts, where people can get access to liquor stores and to, you know, junk food and convenience stores, but they don't get access to the really healthy food that we all need to thrive. So they take these busloads of produce, and they stop at senior centers and at schools and churches and make sure that people can have access to really fresh food. So that was one story I love. They actually have several different farms and gardens around the city of Chicago. The other was New Era Windows, a worker cooperative. It was originally factory workers whose job was being eliminated because the plant was going to move overseas. And they occupied
just like the carrier
factory.
Workers in Indiana.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They occupied their factory because they hadn't been paid when the plant was going to shut down. And they eventually, the owners relented and sold the company to another owner. But when that owner decided to shut down, they were ready, and they were able, through a combination of an occupation and political pressure, they were able to convince the owner to let them buy the plant. So now these workers own this plant, and I went to visit them. And it was so great to see what it's like for these people who had been factory workers, had been disrespected. They were told, you know, their ideas about how to make production work better weren't valuable. They didn't know anything. And now they're running it. And instead of discounting one another and only paying attention to the boss who's paid so much money that it becomes difficult to keep the business running, they're all paid roughly the same. And they listen to each other's ideas, and they're able to make things work by respecting one another and making things go one step at a time.
Does it give them a economically comfortable lifestyle, though? You know, using this model of being in a worker cooperative?
They only have a couple of years under their belt so far. So I think we have yet to see if they'll be able to make it a financial success. One of the things that they like is that they don't have to come up with all that money for the executive salaries, and they also don't have to return huge profits to Wall Street. Because the lender is an organization called Working World that's more interested in the questions of how workers can take control over their own lives. And they're willing to be patient with when the payback happens and at what rate.
And that's such an important aspect, because, you know, we really, you know, we live in a country where corporate models of economic empowerment rule. And, you know, we just saw that Oxfam report where even on a global scale, 8 men now own as much wealth as the poorest half of humanity. In this country is sort of a microcosm of that. And, you know, we have this billionaire taking taking his place in the White House, who may speak through a populist lens, but who has obviously made his money by extracting profits out of the labor of low-wage workers. So let's talk about this. You know, there's much more to discuss with your book, and certainly people can get a copy of your book directly. I know that you're even offering it through the Yes Magazine's website, and we'll give that out later today. But let's put into context these stories in the moment that we're in today. I mean, should the resistance to Trump take the form of urban farming and worker co-ops, as well as marches in the streets?
Absolutely, yeah. Most of my 12,000-mile trip was actually in red states. It wasn't planned that way. I was just looking to get out of the power centers. So I went to places that are impoverished and left out and on the margins, and ended up in a lot of those red states. And yeah, I think that we actually have a combination of things that we need to do in this era of Trump, and there's so much damage that can be done. So we don't have the luxury to not resist. But I think we need to think carefully about how we do it, because marching on the street doesn't necessarily build power. It's certainly worth doing. I'm so glad that people marched this weekend on the Women's March and all over the country. But we also need to be building power in our communities so that we can hold our members of Congress accountable. We can decide who we want to put into office instead of just accepting what the Democratic Party sends our way in the way of candidates, we can make those kinds of decisions. And really importantly, we need to reach out to one another because there's so many vulnerable people in our communities now. We don't know exactly who could be targeted, but there's a pretty good chance that will include immigrants, it will include Muslims, it will include women who are providing health services to other women. So we have some ideas. Anyone that objects to the Trump policies could be targeted either by the administration or by local supporters who just believe that that's the way to enforce the Trump agenda. So we need to reach out to each other and say, you know what, I've got your back. I'll be there if anything happens to you. And if anything happens to me, I want to know who to call too. Instead of waiting for the powers that be to send us a better candidate or a better policy, we need to create the world we want in our communities and band together so that we actually have the power when we collaborate with one another to make things happen in a bigger way.
Right. I mean, the economic resiliency, the climate resiliency, all of these things can start from the ground up because clearly they're not coming from the top down. They hadn't been coming fast enough from the top down under a Democratic administration. If today we were if we were under the presidency of Hillary Clinton, wouldn't these fights and these connections and these community struggles still be just as important?
Yes, I think they absolutely would be just as important. I mean, I think we have to understand the difference between a social movement, which is bottom up, based in grassroots power, and a potentially benign political party that may or may not be accountable to us. I think what we've seen in the Democratic Party is that too often it's accountable to Wall Street and big corporations, and we saw way too many Goldman Sachs folks in the last administration. So if we really wanted to be accountable, the government to be accountable to we the people, we have to build power locally, and we have to build power independently of the Democratic Party. That doesn't mean we don't work on elections, but we have to have that independent stance from which we can hold our elected officials accountable.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book, and thank you for all the work you've done at YES.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Van Gelder is the co-founder and editor-at-large at YES Magazine. We've been discussing her book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America. You can find out more at yesmagazine.org and at revolutionwhereyoulive.org. We'll post those links from our website later today. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.